Monday the 8th of October, Kof Vav Tishrei, Rabbi Shlomo Perin, the duplex sukkah.
So first, I just want to thank the organisers who allowed me to speak in front of such a knowledgeable crowd. Normally I speak in front of Bokhrim, who are from those far-flung places of Tehran and Malmo, which is somewhere in Sweden, I think. But the relevance is that their understanding of the word English is not exactly the same as everyone else's. Is his understanding of the word English, which makes communication a bit more difficult. What I wanted the title of this shiur to be, but I wasn't allowed it actually, was Haskoma Harayot. Now, if everyone thinks of what the paradigm of a halachic dispute in a Jewish halachic dispute would be, the two names which would be at the forefront of such a list would obviously be the Rambam and the Ravid. We know that across the whole of the Yad HaChazakah, the main work of the Rambam, wherever you see the Ravid, it's called Hasogas Ravid for a reason. The challenges of the Ravid. He's not there because he wants to be nice to the Rambam or lend his... I think that's very nice, Rambam. Well done. It's because he wants to challenge the Ravid, right? In fact, so much so that all the halachas that the Rambam brings, which the Ravid doesn't challenge him on, are assumed that the Ravid holds of the Rambam's position 100%. In fact, if you were to compile a list of shittas who hold a particular idea... in any area of halacha, if you see an area where the Rambam is not disagreed with by the Ravid, that would count double points, because it would be automatically assumed that the Ravid agrees with the Rambam. So that being said, there's an interesting halacha relevant to this, which the Ravid does not disagree. So let's have a look. So the Rambam says there's a concept of a sukkah al-gabi sukkah, which people have heard of probably, a sukkah on top of another sukkah. Now the question is, what exactly are the parameters of the upper sukkah that will render the lower sukkah to be a kosher sukkah? The upper one would probably be a kosher sukkah, but what exactly are the parameters that the top one must adhere to make the lower one kosher? So the Rambam brings two particular parameters. So the Rambam says, "Osa sukkah gabi sukkah," somebody who makes a sukkah on top of another one, and he gives two parameters. I'm not going to read out all the Hebrew particularly, but the parameters are, firstly, that the upper one must have a height of 10 tefachim. It must be about this high, or however high it is precisely. Ask whoever deals in Eruvim exactly how high 10 tefachim is. I don't know who that'd be. So it has to be, first of all, it has to be 10 tefachim high, and secondly, it also has to be with a floor that's sturdy enough to support the weight of korim and sotas, of cushions and sheets, presumably for somebody to sleep on, were he to want to, so that the floor is going to be sturdy enough that you wouldn't just fall through it. Because if it would be insufficiently sturdy, that you would fall through it, or at least it wouldn't be something you'd want, the health and safety would probably ban it, then it's not going to be a sufficient enough sukkah to render the lower sukkah a sukkah psula. So those are the two parameters given by the Ravid. He doesn't give the reasons behind them, he just says those two reasons. Excuse me, thank you very much. The Rambam gives two reasons, he doesn't give two parameters, he doesn't give reasons, and then the Ravid says something absolutely astonishing. So Omar Avram says, Avram, the name of the Ravid, Yofa Oslasha Potlak Shmuel. Well done, Rambam, you've done really nicely, you've passed in like Shmuel. Now, I haven't seen all of the Yofa Hazaka, but I've never seen a Ravid which goes out of his way, especially when the Ravid doesn't need to go out of his way, because we know that wherever he says nothing, he agrees with the Rambam, but here he goes out of his way to say, Yofa Oslasha, you've done really well. Well done, Rambam. I mean, the Rambam, since when does the Rambam need support from anyone? I agree, it's from the Ravid, but since when does the Rambam require support? Since when is Hasogas Ravid? I mean, it's wrong here, it says Hasogas Ravid, it should be. Should change it, right? It should say Haskamas Ravid, right? I think this Rambam's very nice. Well, what on earth is the Ravid doing that requires him to go out of his way to say that the Rambam's given a correct halacha? Since when were we hoshed about the Rambam in the first place? And just to make it even worse, there's the little Pirush of the Migdal Oz at the bottom, if I can find it here, and he says, V'aniyola, and I say, Me'afasha Ravid Zeichel Ebracha Messiah, since the Ravid supports him, die. That's enough. End of Rayim, Tuesday, Sizzle. The words of the Rambam do not require any more support. Well, thank you very much. I wasn't aware that the Rambam required support in the first place. What's the Migdal Oz telling us that the Ravid hasn't told us? And what's the Ravid telling us in the first place that we have had a problem with in the Rambam to start off with? So obviously, to understand the Rambam, we have to go back to the source Gemara, which is the Gemara in the Sukkah, to understand exactly what's going on here. So, just to give a quick praise to... So to give a quick praise of exactly what's going on in the Gemara to understand what's happening in the Rambam, essentially the Gemara has a quick shaka v'tari, a back and forth here between itself essentially, asking about an opinion of Shmuel, which was mentioned in the Ravid. We'll see what all these opinions are. We'll see exactly how the Rambam would probably understand this Gemara. We'll see who disagrees with the Rambam about this Gemara, and then hopefully we'll understand why exactly the Ravid had to come out to deliberately tell us that the Rambam Paskin correctly, and why the Migdalos felt that it was necessary for the Raiva to set up at the Rambam Paskin correctly, but once it done so, why that was enough for us to believe that the Rambam was correct. So the Gemara starts like this. It gives an opinion of Shmuel. How high does the upper sukkah have to be to render the lower sukkah invalid? It has to be 10 tefachim, apparently. What's the reasoning of Shmuel? Now, Shmuel doesn't say this himself implicitly. The Gemara quotes, not in the name of Shmuel, that the reasoning is kachshor, kach pasulah. Whatever makes an upper sukkah kosher will automatically make the lower sukkah a pasulah, right? So what validates one automatically invalidates the lower one. Yeah, kachshor of the top one, kach pasulah of the lower one. Whatever makes the top one kosher makes the lower one pasulah. Now, as soon as Shmuel says this, the Gemara challenges it. It uses now an opinion of Rabbi Yehuda in earlier Mishnah. The Mishnah is on Tess on the base, right at the top. So Rabbi Yehuda says there's another parameter as well for the top sukkah to render the lower one a pasulah. What's the other parameter? The words are in ein diurin v'aliona, which the Gemara chooses to understand as it must have the ability to be lived in as well. So whatever the other parameters the upper sukkah requires, the plastic pomegranates or whatever that make a kosher sukkah, but it also has to be have the ability to live in it. So what exactly is this ability? So now the Gemara suggests that perhaps the parameter of Shmuel, the 10 tefachim of Shmuel, the range that he gave, would also supply a sufficient degree of livability to fit into the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. The problem is, if that's true, then the people who disagree with Rabbi Yehuda, or the person, the Tanakhama, whoever he happens to be, would then have to automatically hold as a corollary to this that that a sukkah, the upper sukkah, even if it was less than 10 tefachim, would still qualify as a sukkah. And if it would still qualify as a sukkah, that would disqualify the lower sukkah. But it's absurd to assume that a gap, which is only, let's say, 5 tefachim, would be considered a sukkah al-gabi sukkah. How is that a sukkah al-gabi sukkah? It's not a sukkah, it's only 5 tefachim gap, or however big 5 tefachim happens to be. Right? Why that opinion that we'd have to insert into the Tanakhama is nonsensical. So it seems obvious, according to the Gemara, that it cannot be that Shmuel's opinion of 10 tefachim is what Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, who says it must have a degree of livability in the upper sukkah as well, it cannot be that those two opinions match. Now the question against the Gemara is, well, if it's obvious that they can't match, why did the Gemara ever suggest Shmuel to be the option in Rabbi Yehuda in the first place? Let's just take this Gemara a bit further, we'll answer that in a minute, I hope. So let's see the next part of the Gemara. So the Gemara suggests an alternative. Now how this alternative works, I think, might be a matter of discussion between the Rashi and the Rambam, we'll see. So the Gemara then suggests an alternative brought by Rav Dimi, that really the upper sukkah has to have a solid enough floor, which was the other parameter mentioned by the Rambam. And what does that mean? It has to be able to hold korim lekasotus, the aforementioned sheets and cushions, to prevent somebody falling through. Now the Gemara then instantly challenges that as well. Well, that means that if Rabbi Yehuda says you have to have a solid enough floor to allow sheets and cushions to be supported on it, then that means the Tanakhama allows you to have a floor which even sheets and cushions won't be sufficient for. Well, and that's also an absurd option. So how can you suggest that Rav Dimi, who brought this idea about sheets and cushions on the floor of the upper sukkah, how can you suggest that that's what Rabbi Yehuda is talking about if the corollary is the Tanakhama, who must hold the opposite, will therefore allow you to get away with an upper sukkah with a completely useless floor that where you stand on it, you'd fall through to the lower sukkah? How can that be defined as a halakhically kosher sukkah on the top one enough to render the lower sukkah a pasulah? So we've got two questions against the Gemara so far. What was the Havamina? What was the expectation that Shmuel would be a valid understanding in Rabbi Yehuda to start off with? Shmuel, who said 10 tefachim is the necessity for livability in Rabbi Yehuda. And then the second question, who on earth had thought that Rav Dimi would be a valid interpretation of Rabbi Yehuda? That to have korim kasotus would be enough to render livability, even though that would require the Tanakhama to say that you could just fall straight through it. How on earth do these two Havaminas work? Now, finally, the Gemara answers, actually using Rav Dimi, that the Tanakhama's opinion must be that the floor must be able to hold sheets and cushions, korim kasotus, ali de'ezachak. Right? We're in a just about type fashion, right? You wouldn't want to push it, but it could just about hold. Ali de'ezachak, it could just about hold a sheet or a cushion, but you wouldn't want to risk your chances. Apparently that would be the opinion of the Tanakhama. So let's just run through this Gemara again. So first of all, we've got an opinion of Shmuel. The opinion of Shmuel is that the height of the upper sukkah has to be 10 tefachim. Then we've got the reasoning of Shmuel that what makes the upper sukkah kosher makes the lower sukkah psula. Then we've got the question against that. Well, surely that would mean that the Tanakhama, who argue with Rabbi Yehuda, say that any height of an upper sukkah would still be enough, which is extremely unlikely. So the Gemara answers with an alternative. The alternative of Rav Dimi, that maybe it's to do with having a sufficiently sturdy enough floor to prevent sheets and cushions falling through, to which the Gemara says, in which case the Tanakhama allows you to have a completely diaphanous floor which you'd be able to go straight through, which is again unlikely, and the Gemara answers, no, the Tanakhama still requires a degree of sturdiness, but it doesn't, just about to hold sheets and cushions, not, but perhaps not enough for any more than that. So maybe that, the expectation of the Gemara, when it inserts Shmuel into Rabbi Yehuda and says that Rabbi Yehuda allows a, or assumes a degree of livability in the upper sukkah as soon as it's 10 to 12 in this space like this. Now we know, in general, sukkahs have to be 10 to 12 and high. Right, that's a solid measurement given. And it's, and generally the measurements about the sukkah are assumed to be based on livability. That's a given. It has to be patient who can aim to do it. The way you dwell in it would be the way you sit in it would be the way you dwell in your house. And less than 10 tefachim would not be considered a house. But you could theorize a situation where a slightly shorter sukkah, let's say 7 tefachim, it wouldn't be completely uninhabitable. Right, you would be able to lie in it. If you wanted to sleep in a sukkah, you wouldn't need more than 7 tefachim. Right, you could slide yourself in. I think like they have these hotels in Tokyo where you just get like little cabinets in a wall. You know, people slide you out in the morning. Shoebox in the wall. Right. So in theory, you could get away with some sort of habitation less than 7 tefachim. Now it wouldn't be halakhically valid, but it could be suggested that even though it's not halakhically valid, since it still conforms to some sort of ability to live in it, at least according to Japanese standards, perhaps. But maybe since it conforms to that, maybe it would still be enough to make the upper sukkah powerful to be opposed on the lower sukkah, even if not necessarily kosher of its own accord. So maybe that's what the Gemara expects, and the Gemara is going to work like this then. The Gemara suggests that the Rabbi Yehuda would require a 10 tefach upper sukkah, and maybe the Tanakhama would say only a 7 tefach upper sukkah. Not that that would make it kosher, but at least it would allow a degree of livability. And if at least you can live in it, then the lower sukkah would be kosher. Says the Gemara, that's absurd, that's not possible, but the 10 tefach amount is an absolute, you can't break it, even if in theory a very small person or somebody in a Japanese hotel would be able to get it lower than that. But nonetheless, you can still, you can't get lower than 10 tefachim, and that's going to be the be-all and end-all. And then the second question in the Gemara, let's insert the opinion, the parameter of Rav Dimi that you have to have a floor that can support korim and kasasas, the sheets and the cushions. So maybe what's happening there, one moment, perhaps what's happening there is that since we're working with a parameter which is much more vague, 10 tefachim is an absolute, right? 10 tefachim is exactly 10 tefachim. Okay, you can argue what the tefach is perhaps, but it's a certain deliberate amount. But when you're dealing with something that can withhold sheets and cushions, well, how many cushions? What's the cushion? How fat is the cushion? Right? Are we talking with Dunlop pillows here, or are we dealing with feather pillows? There's a lot of factors which could alter exactly a person's definition of sheets and pillows, right? So perhaps the Gemara's expectation is that even though Rabbi Yehuda will allow a floor which can support sheets and pillows, that won't cause the Tanakhama to allow a completely useless floor. It'll be a floor which can support slightly less firm sheets and pillows, perhaps. So that's how to understand the Gemara. Now, in contrast to this, as far as I can tell, when I read the Gemara, and I think how the Rambam reads the Gemara as well, is the Pashtus reading of the Gemara. This is in major contrast, to Rashi. So just to highlight what the contrast is, I'm not going to read it through in the Rashi, but Rashi understands the second question. The second question, which I initially represented as a question against Rav Dimi, the Gemara, Rashi understands as another question against Shmuel. And how does that work? He says that when Rav Dimi suggests the parameter of sheets and cushions, that's still in the understanding of Shmuel that sheets and cushions aren't just another parameter, but they also work with this idea of kashara kach psula. Whatever makes it kosher will also make the lower one psula. Right, so even though it's not the manifestation of Shmuel, the initial manifestation of Shmuel is that livability requires 10 tefachim, a height. But it's still within Talmud of Shmuel, it's still within the reasoning of Shmuel, according to Rashi, and therefore the Gemara suggestion brought by Rav Dimi that the floor has to hold Korim HaKasotis is really just another manifestation of Shmuel's reasoning, and therefore the question asked by the Gemara, well, surely that's absurd because the corollary in the Tanakhama will be impossible, he'll require a floor which is completely and utterly useless, is going to be a question against Shmuel again. So we've now got two questions against Shmuel, and then the answer is that we're going to have the answer is that, how does the Gemara phrase it? The Tanakhama will allow you a bit of leeway to allow very fine cushions and pillows which will stop, which the floor will just about be able to support. So just to summarise, so we have the Pashtus reading of the Gemara, which has one question against Shmuel and then one question against Rav Dimi, and we have the new understanding of the Gemara brought by Rashi, which is two questions against Shmuel. Now, just to highlight how difficult it is to insert this question against Shmuel, Rashi adds two major words into the understanding of the Gemara. And he doesn't add words into the Rashi explanation, he adds words into the Dibra HaMatzil, the words that actually quote the Gemara, he has to alter drastically. He adds in the words, where are we here? He adds in the words, Uparthinon, and we ask a question, right, against Shmuel, which was not the expectation based on the Parshas of the Gemara. And later on, he adds in another word, Umishani, and we answer. Right, Rashi adds in those words to highlight the fact that we're asking yet another question against Shmuel. It's not just a side question which we're going to pose against, Rav Dimi. It's another powerful question against Shmuel, working with this theory of the Gemara that was right at the beginning. So just to highlight the fact that the Rashi is not working with the Parshas, even he concedes that it's not the Parshas. Why he does that, we'll see. Hopefully, at that time. But even he concedes that it's not the Parshas, so we're going to have to adapt things a little bit in the Gemara to be able to fit the understanding of Rashi that it's really two questions against Shmuel. To highlight one more point, which is going to be a problem in Rashi in general, which is obviously going to be an advantage for the Rambam. One of the problems here that we have with Rashi is that the Havamina in the first section was that we would be allowed some sort of intermediate the value of the height of the sukkah, for instance, 7 tefachim, even though it's not halachically a sukkah, perhaps it would still be livable in, and that havamina was disqualified. And instantly we try again another identical havamina, or maybe some sort of intermediate, just about being able, alidei havachach, being able to withstand korim hakenotes would be sufficient as well. Now, it seems to be that the Gemara used two identical havaminas, two identical expectations, despite the fact that the first one was utterly destroyed. It then comes back with an identical one again. So in Rashi, we'd have to find why exactly there's a difference between the first half a minute and the second half a minute. Okay, I've got a few nods here, that's good. Alright, let me just try that again. The disadvantage here in Rashi is that the first half a minute and the second half a minute appear to be working with more or less the same lines. And if they are, then how can the Gemara work with an identical one after the first one's just been destroyed? Surely it should be destroyed along the same grounds. So we said you can make a chiluk that the concept of ten tefachim is a very... Right, what was the word?
Absolute.
Yeah, the concept of 10 tefachim was an absolute amount. It may well be that you can live underneath, but there's no arguing that 10 tefachim is 10 tefachim is 10 tefachim. Whereas being able to carry sheets and cushions is a very vague quantity. It's something you could parley about with much more ease. Okay, fine. So you'd have to make that distinction in Rashi. It works, but it's not easy, and it will be one of the negative qualities of Rashi's understanding of the Gemara, and therefore a positive advantage, because all advantages are positive, for the Rambam. Fine. Now, the outcome of Rashi's understanding is that the final part of the Gemara works that Shmuel now holds like the Tanakhama. Shmuel holds like Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says you have to have a degree of livability in the sukkah. What causes a degree of livability? A solid floor. Why is a solid floor a problem? Because if you have a solid floor, that makes the top sukkah kosher, which makes the bottom sukkah potel. So Rabbi Yehuda holds like Shmuel. And contrary to that, the Tanakhama therefore does not hold like Shmuel. Okay, that's a relevant point. That Rabbi Yehuda does hold like Shmuel using the Talmud of Shmuel, the reasoning of Shmuel, and the Tanakhama, who says that you do not require this degree of livability, you just need some sort of general kashrus, does not hold like Shmuel. Okay, and this is exactly the point which it seems that the Ravid disagrees with. Okay, I've got the Rambam sharp there, but the Ravid says essentially like this. So he says, Yofa Osa Sheposak Shmuel. The Ravid says the Rambam's done extremely well. He's given a pasak like Shmuel that you have to have 10 tefachim height, and you've also given a pasak like the Tanakhama. Now, according to Rashi, it's impossible to have a pasak like Shmuel and the Tanakhama. If you've got Shmuel, then you're going to have to work with Rabbi Yehuda. You cannot work with the Tanakhama. Right? It's one or the other. So the Rambam works with Shmuel in 10 tefachim and Rabbi Yehuda that you require a solid floor. But according to Rashi, Shmuel does not fit with the Tanakhama. He only fits with Rabbi Yehuda. Have I said it all the right way around? I think I got it. So let's just try one more time. So according to the Rambam, you hold like Shmuel and the Rabbi Yehuda and Tanakhama, there we go. You hold like Shmuel and the Tanakhama. You hold like Shmuel, you need 10 tefachim. You hold like the Tanakhama that you need whereas I think I've got myself confused somewhere. If anyone feels like they know where it is, let me know. Okay. But the Rashi, according to the Gemara, cannot hold the same two people simultaneously. Okay, so to understand why Shmuel and why the Rambam and Rashi would choose to learn the Gemara in a different fashion, perhaps we can look at all the positive and negative sides of it. So to sum up for Rashi, the advantage in Rashi is that the Gemara flows very, very neatly. The way I presented the Parshas was that we had a reasoning of Shmuel, a questioning against Shmuel, the question finishes, doesn't work, we try an alternative with Rav Zimi, and then we ask a question against Rav Zimi, unrelated to Shmuel. With Rashi, we have a major advantage that the Gemara's flow, the Gemara's continuity and parallelism across the two questions is much, much neater. A, because we're asking against Shmuel in both times, and not just are we asking against Shmuel, but we're also asking not just Shmuel, but again, but using Talmud of Shmuel. What we apparently know is the reasoning of Shmuel. The first question is against the reasoning of Shmuel of Kahakshara Kahsara, and the second question is against an identical reasoning, albeit a slightly different manifestation, not in height, but in sturdiness of the floor. So Rashi has that major advantage for his side. Of course, the Rambam's advantage is that you don't have to insert this very tenuous second question against Shmuel, which is not obvious in the Gemara, and even Rashi agrees that it's not obvious in the Gemara, as you see from the fact that he's added in these extra words. Now, the second question in the Gemara about how can you insert the parameter of the sturdiness of the floor into Rabbi Yehuda, if that means that the Tanakhama will allow you to have almost a non-existent floor, perhaps we can understand the machlokas of the Rambam and the Rashi in terms of this as well. Perhaps Rashi understands this as being a genuine halakhic problem. If you don't have a sturdy floor, you do not have a sukkah. Right? In fact, Rashi adds two words again, which are not in the Gemara. He says the sturdiness of the floor has to be, what exactly are his words? It has to be bria v'chazaka, which means healthy and strong. Now, the Gemara never says the floor has to be healthy and strong. It says it has to be able to support sheets and cushions. Right? What is bria v'chazaka business? And also, Rashi adds in another word, which is not in the Gemara, it has to be leishen, it has to be fitting for sleeping on. Right? The Gemara never said that. Agreed. The implication is in the Gemara that if you're going to have sheets and cushions, you're going to have to sleep there as well. But that's not necessarily highlighted by the Gemara at all. Rashi has to add that in to point out that we're not just dealing with a flimsy floor that you could throw a sheet across, which probably any sort of floor would be able to withstand, but you're actually going to be able to have to sleep there as well. Whereas the Rambam, and the Rambam would make no mention of that in the slightest. So perhaps the difference between the Rambam and Rashi, or the Rambam and the Rambam against Rashi, is that according to Rashi, we're dealing with a solid halakhic parameter here, which if you don't have an ability to genuinely sleep on it, then you're not going to have a sukkah, right? It's the shame sukkah, the actual halakhic entity of sukkah will not exist unless you have a physical usefulness within the sukkah. Whereas the Rambam and the Rizvid might understand the business about throwing over sheets as something which is just a sheer practicality. Well, who cares whether you have a sukkah on top of it? If you can't use it, then it's meaningless, right? So we're going to differentiate between a halakhic understanding of Korim and Kesophos, which is according to Rashi, whereas as opposed to a sheer practicality in the which is seen in the Rivet. In fact, if I could read out the Lashon of the Rivet, it's not the title at the moment, you'd see that that does seem to be the implication of the Rivet quite precisely. That according to the Rambam, the necessity for Korim and Kesophos is just purely for somebody to walk across it. In fact, the Lecha Mishnah talks about a theoretical light-footed person, I suppose, like a tightrope walker would be able to design a sukkah which you could just like tiptoe across, and it wouldn't be able to support anything. But if you're sufficiently light-footed and you've got a good sense of balance, you wouldn't fall through the floor. So obviously, we're not talking about a halakhic definition of sukkah support strength, right, of PSI on your floor or whatever it happens to be, but we're dealing with something which is just a degree of practicality as far as creation of the sukkah is concerned. So the difference between the Rambam and the Rashi is that Rashi is now dealing with a halakhic issue all the way across. Halakhically, a 10 tefach sukkah is the minimal, although in theory, to live in it, you'd be able to get away with less. A halakhic sukkah has to have a solid floor that you can even sleep on, right? And that's bria v'chazaka, it's healthy and strong, right? So Rashi has this advantage that the first question is a halakhic question, the second question is a halakhic question. The Rambam has a disadvantage that the first question is not a halakhic question, but the second issue is just a minor practicality, a technicality in how to construct a sukkah, which is not going to fall in when you walk in it. Otherwise, it's not really a sukkah, is it, if you can't stand in the thing? But it's not a halakhic issue per se, it's a practical issue. So Rashi has the advantage that the two questions are both halakhic. The flow in the Gemara is much more sound, whereas the Rambam has to shift from a halakhic question to a practical question, which is less sound, relatively speaking. So just to summarise, the problem as I brought it in the first place was that the Rambam normally is attacked by the Rivet. It's not called Hasoga to Rivet, the challenges of the Rivet for nothing, right? He's out there to attack the Rambam at every possible point. In fact, we see that the Rambam's Loshon, his style, his language that he uses against the Rambam is some of the most powerful Loshon you see by Rishon, right? He comes up extremely strongly against the Rambam on numerous occasions. So it's, and to the extent, as we said, that when he doesn't say anything, it's assumed to be 100% support of the Rambam, to the extent that you can even take it as a double shitter that holds that opinion if the Rambam says nothing. Which is very strange, certainly, to see the Rambam come out in full support of the Rambam, completely, apparently, unnecessarily. Now, in light of this Gemara, on Daf Yud Amud Aleph in Sukkah, we can suddenly understand what exactly the differences between the Rambam and the Gemara that require perhaps a degree of support from the Ravid. Because the Gedolei HaMeforshim, I think actually the Gedolei HaDarshanim, as the Meiri calls him, the Rashi here, the greatest of the commentators, says, understands the Gemara in a completely and utterly different way from the Rambam. Now, if I was the Rambam, I wouldn't fancy being attacked by Rashi. That's the long and short of it. So even though the Rambam has a perfectly valid way of understanding the Gemara, in fact, the Rambam's way is actually the Pashas of reading the Gemara, but there are problems with this Pashas, right? We don't have the flow in the Gemara through Shmuel. We don't have the flow in the Gemara using just one Talmud of Shmuel. We don't have the flow in the Gemara just using one method of questioning. One halakhic question is going to appear and one practical question is going to appear. So with all of those problems, it apparently was necessary for the Raivad to come out in support of the Rambam, even though, of course, there were problems with Rashi. We don't have any notice per se of the second question against Shmuel in the Gemara. It's not in Pashas understood like that. But even though there are those problems in Rashi, Rashi does have the upper hand in certain ways, and perhaps because of that minor upper hand, relatively speaking, the Raivad has to support the Rambam to the extent that the Migdal Oz says, well, it's a bit of a relief that the Raivad supports him, because perhaps the Rambam's view would be too tenuous on his own, because of course he has the power of Rashi against him.